Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, February 25th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing some of the legal and constitutional issues surrounding gun control in the wake of the Newtown tragedy. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of our two experts of about 10 to 12 minutes, followed by an exchange between those experts, followed by your questions. Mr. John G. Malcolm is a senior legal fellow in the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, where his work focuses on criminal law, immigration, national security, and religious liberty. Importantly, he's also chairman of the Federalist Society's Criminal Law Practice Group Executive Committee. Mr. Jonathan Lowy is director of the Legal Action Project of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, where he represents communities whose gun laws are challenged in the courts and victims who have been injured by gun industry negligence, including victims of the D.C. area sniper shootings. And with that, Mr. Malcolm, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you very much, Dean. And I'm delighted to be here with all of you today telephonically. This is obviously a very important topic, and there's a lot more that I could say than in the 10 to 12 minutes that I've been allotted. I'm hoping, though, that we'll cover some of the issues that I don't mention in my initial remarks during the Q&A period. Let me begin by stating something that I assume all of us believe, and that is that what happened in December at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, was horrific, and that anybody who did not feel deep pain in their heart that day doesn't have a heart. You know, nobody wants to see this kind of thing happen again, although I think we have to deal with the reality that it could. I think it is important in a situation like this to take a deep breath, step back, look at all of the complex cultural factors that are in play, analyze the best data that's available, and to try to come up with measures that are most likely to work while still protecting our civil liberties. Some of these answers might lie at the federal level. However, I suspect that most of them will lie with state and local governments that have primary responsibility under our Constitution for exercising police power to keep us safe, and also for providing for the severely mentally ill, who are the perpetrators of the vast majority of these mass shooting events. Now, let me state at the beginning, I don't own a gun, and I'm not a member of the NRA, and I got nothing against Piers Morgan. But what I do care about is the Constitution. I care about the rights of law-abiding citizens to defend themselves, and I also care about implementing sound public policy that does not impinge upon the constitutional rights of law-abiding citizens. What's important in the aftermath of a tragedy like this is to take action that's going to be effective, not just action that feels right. So in 2008, in the Heller case, the Supreme Court held that the Second Amendment protects the right of individuals to keep and bear arms. It's an individual fundamental right. And in 2010, in the McDonald case, the court held that this fundamental right also applied against state and local governments. Now, there are a lot of people out there, including many, but by no means all, gun control proponents who would like to excise the Second Amendment from the Constitution, because they believe it's dangerous and unsuitable to modern times. Now, not surprisingly, gun control proponents focus on the ways in which criminals misuse certain firearms. They tend to de-emphasize the ways that law-abiding citizens can make lawful defensive use of many of these same firearms. Now, the framers of our Constitution were practical men who were familiar with people who misuse guns. They were also familiar with responsible citizens who engaged in lawful defensive gun use. And in propounding the Second Amendment, the framers opted to side with the responsible citizens. In doing so, they were aware of the fact that throughout history, monarchs, including George III, had attempted to disarm those people who opposed them in order to oppress them. And there are a lot of modern dictators who have done the same thing to subdue their citizens as well. It is not by accident, I would posit, that the Second Amendment comes just before the Third Amendment, which severely limits the government's power to quarter troops in people's homes. That having been said, the Supreme Court has acknowledged that the Second Amendment is not absolute. The Second Amendment, the court held, applies to weapons, quote, typically possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes, but does not apply to, quote, dangerous and unusual weapons. Additionally, the court also made clear, quote, nothing in our opinion, this is Heller, should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. Now, while not in any way meaning to minimize the terrible effects of gun violence, particularly in mass shooting events, I think it's important to keep this in perspective. Over the last 30 years, the homicide rate in this country has declined by over 50%, from 10.2 per 100,000 in 1980 to 4.7 per 100,000 of the population in 2011. That was the lowest rate since 1964, when the homicide rate was 4.6 per 100,000. At the same time that the homicide rate has been dropping dramatically, gun ownership in this country has increased dramatically. In 1964, per capita gun ownership was 0.45, so less than one gun per two Americans. Today, it is estimated that there are slightly more guns than there are Americans in this country. Gun ownership is very high in countries like Switzerland and Israel, New Zealand and Finland, yet the murder rates in those countries are very low. In our country, gun ownership is much higher in rural areas, yet the murder rates are much higher in urban areas. Now, not surprisingly after Newtown, the immediate, some might say Pavlovian response, was to call for more gun control, including a reenactment of the so-called assault weapons ban that was in effect in this country from 1994 to 2004. It's worth noting that after the assault weapons ban lapsed in 2004, the Department of Justice commissioned a study of its effects from some esteemed criminologists at the University of Pennsylvania, and that study concluded, and I quote, "We cannot clearly credit the ban with any of the nation's recent drop in gun violence, and indeed there has been no discernible reduction in the lethality and injuriousness of gun violence based on indicators like the percentage of gun crimes resulting in death or the share of gunfire incidents resulting in injury. Should it be renewed, the ban's effects on gun violence are likely to be small at best, perhaps too small for reliable measurement." As well, during the time that the ban was in effect, there were over two dozen shooting events at schools, including, of course, the horrific events at Columbine High School, where Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold killed 12 of their classmates and a teacher, and they wounded 27 others before turning the guns on themselves. Now, this should not be too surprising. First of all, most gun crimes, including those that result in death, are committed with handguns, not assault weapons. Second, the term assault weapon was invented by gun control proponents for political and public relations purposes and has been applied to guns that look mean. The term assault weapon has no firm definition, other than the fact that it's been applied to certain cosmetic features of semi-automatic weapons, such as a folding stock and a flash suppressor that make these semi-automatic weapons look like fully automatic weapons, even though they're not. You know, you can take a Honda and make it look like a Ferrari, but when you start the engine, it is still going to perform like a Honda. In many cases, the weapons that were covered by the prior assault weapons ban were less powerful than guns that were not covered by the ban, and the same can be said for the current draft legislation that's being debated. Now, in addition to the fact that criminals can usually get whatever guns they want to on the black market or through theft or through straw purchasers, they are not stupid and can easily replace assault semi-automatic guns with other semi-automatic guns that are the functional equivalents and that have not been banned. If gun control were the answer, people would be safer in countries like Brazil and Russia and Mexico that have incredibly strict gun control laws, far stricter than our country's gun control laws, when in fact the violent crime rates in those countries are much higher than they are here. Similarly, you'd expect to see high violent crime in states like North Dakota that have very lax gun control laws, when in fact the violent crime rate is quite low there. And you would expect to see very low crime rates, violent crime rates, in cities like Chicago and New York and Washington, D.C. and Oakland, which have the strictest gun laws in the country. But in fact, the violent crime rates in those countries are persistently high. I'd also note, by the way, that violent crime rates back in the 40s and 50s and 60s were relatively low when there were very few gun control laws to speak of. And during those times, you could go into a hardware store and buy guns and ammunition and dynamite, and you could order rifles and shotguns from a Sears Christmas catalog. Now, there's a lot more that I could talk about high-capacity magazines, background checks, and I assume we'll get to some of that in the QA. I do want to spend a little bit of time during my initial remarks focusing on an area that I think might prove helpful in preventing massacres such as the one that occurred in Newtown. So I'd like to spend a couple of minutes talking about mental illness. We need to recognize that there is a difference between these mass shooting events and other types of shooting events like suicide, gang violence, drug-related violence, and domestic disputes. There are, unfortunately, some very deeply disturbed people out there who are determined, psychotic, isolated, and often suicidal. These people are not going to be deterred by the prospect of a long-term prison sentence or by the death penalty. The vast majority of these mass shooting events have been committed by severely mentally ill people who are not receiving the treatment that they so desperately need. A study by Mother Jones magazine, of all sources, looked at mass shooting events over the last three decades and determined that at least 38 out of 62 of these events, and likely far more, the perpetrators of these events had displayed signs of severe mental health problems prior to the killings. Recent analyses of various studies have found that schizophrenia, these are people who suffer from paranoid delusions, increased the risk of acting violently fourfold in men and more than that with respect to women. In general, somebody with schizophrenia is more than 10 times likely to commit homicide than your average citizen. Now, prior to the mid-60s, a lot of these shooting events were prevented because these severely mentally ill people were institutionalized. Starting in the 1960s, assisted by the Supreme Court in a couple of seminal cases in the 70s, we began a deinstitutionalization movement and released a lot of these people into the community so that they could get treatment. Unfortunately, they didn't, and they don't. The National Institute of Mental Health estimates that there are about 7.7 million Americans who currently qualify as severely mentally ill, and at any given time, 3.5 million of them are not receiving any treatment at all. Now, recent studies have suggested that doctors may be getting better at identifying risk factors that will enable them to do a better job of predicting which mentally ill people are likely to commit violence. Additionally, studies have shown that states with overly restrictive civil commitment laws are far more likely, one-third more likely, to suffer violence at the hands of an untreated mentally ill person than in states with more permissive standards. I would posit that perhaps it's time for states to reevaluate their civil commitment laws and the amount and mix of resources that they devote to treating the mentally ill who are in their communities. And of course, once people have been adjudicated mentally ill, that information should be entered into the background system. Let me close with a quote from Thomas Paine, who wrote in 1894, "The supposed quietude of a good man allures the ruffian, while on the other hand, arms, like laws, discourage and keep the invader and plunderer in awe and preserve order in the world as property. The same balance would be preserved were all the world destitute of arms, for all would be alike. But since some will not, others dare not lay them aside. Horrid mischief would ensue were the law-abiding deprived of the use of them." With that, let me turn it over to John Lowy.
Okay, thank you, John. This is John Lowy. First, let me give some background about the scope of the problem that we're talking about, and then make clear what we are not talking about and what I think we are talking about. I think there's a lot more agreement here, I would hope, than disagreement. There are approximately 100,000 people who are shot every year in America. About 30,000 of them are killed. Some of are suicides, some are homicides, some are unintentional shootings. And while we pay a great deal of attention to the mass shootings, like the horrific shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary, most of these shootings do not occur in mass shootings, and most of them don't reach the headlines as those high-profile cases do. And so I agree with John Malcolm that we should look to see how we can prevent the most violence and save the most lives. One thing we are not talking about here today is whether to do away with the Second Amendment or the recognized constitutional rights of law-abiding citizens. We can, we should, and we must respect the Second Amendment. And the Supreme Court's opinion in Heller and McDonald is the law of the land. There is no dispute about that. We're also not talking about, or I'm not talking about here today, the efficacy of exercising the recognized Second Amendment rights of law-abiding, responsible citizens to have a gun for self-defense in the home. We may disagree about the numbers of times where that is effective, and we may disagree about some of the risks compared to the benefits of gun ownership, but I'm not going to focus on that today. What I hope we talk about today is how we can minimize and reduce gun violence to save lives while fully respecting the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding citizens. And let me talk to you about some specific real-world examples where some of the proposals that are being considered on Capitol Hill now and will be in the coming weeks actually would have an effect. A number of years ago, there was a neo-Nazi by the name of Benjamin Smith, who also had a domestic violence record, which prohibited him from possessing guns or buying guns under federal law. Under the neo-Nazi quote-unquote church that he belonged to, he believed that Jews, African-Americans, Asians, and some others were, quote, mud people. He wanted to do something about that. He went into a gun store to try to buy a gun. He was denied. The background check system worked. Yet he, when he left the store, he looked at the classified ads, and there he found someone who was selling guns, a, quote, private seller, an unlicensed person selling guns, no questions asked. Smith bought two guns from this person. No background check was required because this was a private, quote, unquote, private sale. And under federal law today, background checks are required for sales, gun sales by licensed gun dealers, but they are not required for gun sales by unlicensed persons, which means that you can be a convicted felon, dangerously mentally ill, domestic violence abuser, and simply go to an unlicensed person and buy guns, no questions asked. The most prominent example of this is at gun shows, but there are many others. But at gun shows, literally, in most states, a convicted felon can go to a gun show, and on one side of the aisle, there are licensed gun sellers who will do a background check and would not sell that person a gun, yet they can simply go to the other side of the aisle and buy that same gun, no questions asked. That is a little like if we had a law about controlled substances that said that to buy certain types of controlled substances, you need a prescription from a doctor and then need to take that prescription to a pharmacy, unless you don't want to do that, in which case you could buy them, no questions asked, from a private drug seller. That is the state of our gun laws in America. But to get back to Benjamin Smith, he went to this private seller, he bought his guns, no questions asked, and he went on a rampage in Illinois and Indiana, targeting Jews, African-Americans, Asians. He killed Ricky Birdsong, who is the former basketball coach at Northwestern University, who was jogging with his children in a nice neighborhood in the suburbs of Chicago. He killed Won Joon Yoon, who was a Korean graduate student who was walking to church services at Indiana University. And he shot many others. Now, it's my view, and it's our view, at the Brady Center and Brady Campaign that background checks should be required for all gun sales, and that it makes no sense in that case for Benjamin Smith to simply have this other avenue where he could buy guns, no questions asked. This is not simply my view and our view at Brady. This is about 90% of the American people support this modest change in our law. And tellingly, according to polls, 74% of NRA members and gun owners also support requiring a background check for all gun sales. That is something that I hope we can all agree on. We may quibble about how many lives exactly that proposal would save. I would say that if it were your son, your wife, your husband, your brother, your sister, your mother, your father who was shot, you would agree that one life saved is more than enough to warrant this sort of legislation. So that is the primary proposal that I would focus on, and I don't think there should be any dispute that universal background checks would be completely constitutional. I can talk briefly about the assault weapons and respond to some of the points that John Malcolm made and then get to questions. Assault weapons, Mr. Malcolm said that they are cosmetic features that make them look menacing, which is often said, and it's always inaccurate. The definitional criteria for assault weapons, and those are criteria set forth in legislation, for our purposes, the relevant definition is that set forth in assault weapons legislation. Those relate to functional aspects of the gun, functional aspects which make the gun useful for mass killers like Adam Lanza and the Columbine killers and many others, but of little or no use to law-abiding citizens. That isn't to say that everyone who owns an assault weapon is a mass killer waiting to happen, or that it is impossible to use an assault weapon for lawful purposes. But I'm saying that there are attributes that make them extremely useful for mass killers, as is shown by the fact that mass killers use them so often, and yet you can fully exercise your lawful Second Amendment rights with other weapons without those attributes. And to focus on the most prominent ones, for an assault rifle, having a pistol grip assault rifle that can take a detachable magazine, which can be a high capacity magazine, 30 round, 50 round, or 100 round drum, as was used in the Aurora movie theater shooting, makes that gun into a very potent weapon for mass murder. Yet it is not needed to defend your home. It would shred your venison before you can eat it, or put a trophy up on the wall. And so it makes sense to restrict civilian possession of those sorts of weapons while allowing for a host of semi-automatic handguns, other rifles, shotguns to be possessed lawfully. Secondly, Mr. Malcolm talked about Mexico and Chicago as examples of jurisdictions with strong gun laws, yet large gun violence rates. Those actually show the importance and efficacy of strong gun laws, because the guns in Mexico and in Chicago don't come from there. The reason they don't come from there is because those laws are tough. What happens in Chicago is the guns that flood their streets come from outside of Chicago, in places where the gun laws are weaker. I'll give another real-world example of a young man who was a veteran of the Iraq War and a Chicago police officer who was shot and killed outside of his parents' home in Chicago. That gun that used to shoot him did not come from Chicago. It came from Mississippi, where gun laws are very loose. Traffickers purchased them and then brought them up to Chicago. What's happened in Mexico is many guns are purchased either at gun shows or from private sellers in the border states, particularly places like Texas and Arizona, often in high-volume sales of assault weapons, and then they are brought across the border. The reason the traffickers come to Texas and Arizona is because Mexico's gun laws are strong and Texas and Arizona's gun laws are weak. Again, it highlights the importance and efficacy of strong gun laws. And I would note, those are gun laws that do not prevent law-abiding citizens from exercising their Second Amendment rights, but they do make it harder for dangerous people to get guns. They also highlight the need for strong federal gun laws. And that's a point where I strongly disagree with Mr. Malcolm, because it is extraordinarily easy, of course, as it should be, to cross state borders in this country. And I'm not suggesting it shouldn't be, but because it is extremely easy to traffic guns from, for example, Mississippi to the streets of Chicago. And Chicago or Illinois can have the strongest gun laws that it can get. And yet, without strong federal gun laws, there tends to be a race to the bottom, and guns are then trafficked into places from weak gun law states into strong gun law states. So I'll wrap up briefly, but I would say that I hope, particularly after the tragedy at Sandy Hook, that we come together and not simply have a reflexive view of an issue being a liberal issue, a conservative issue, a right-left issue. This is a public safety issue, and it was not so long ago that this was considered a crime, law and order issue, not a political wedge issue. And I think that the Heller decision makes it easier to look at the gun issue that way again, because the Second Amendment rights of Americans are secured by the Supreme Court, and there can no longer be a parade of horribles that a sensible gun law may, in the eyes of some, potentially lead to total confiscation or a total gun ban. That cannot happen in America today. And so we can look in the middle at sensible gun policies like universal background checks and hopefully come together to save lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to give this is Dean Reuter again. I want to give John Malcolm now a chance to respond. If you could just take a minute or two, a lot's been said, but we've got quite a few people on the call, so I'm anxious to get to questions. But John Malcolm.
Yeah, a lot has been said. Kind of tough to do in a couple of minutes, but let me say this. John makes the statement, I think it's somewhat cavalier, that assault weapons bans don't deal with cosmetics, they deal with functionality, but the functionality only is good for the mass shooter and not for the law-abiding citizen who wants to defend him or herself. To the extent to which these features do have some effect on functionality, like a pistol grip, it has to do with limiting the recoil and making the gun easier to stabilize so that you can point it and shoot it with a certain consistency, or to make the gun so you can adjust it to your body size. I would say that to those functions, are every bit as applicable, if not more so, to the law-abiding citizen who is trying to get an intruder who is caught by surprise and who needs to respond quickly and who will be nervous. Now, with respect to universal background checks, there's a lot I could say, but I'll try to keep it brief. First of all, there are tons of problems with the existing system of background checks. There are millions of people who are currently prohibited from purchasing a gun that are not in the background system that need to be. In 2012, the Government Accounting Office found that there were dozens of states that were not submitting any information, some states like Massachusetts because of state laws, into the background check system for people who have been adjudicated mentally ill. And that study found that 8 states were responsible for 84% of the database's mental health records. Look, Sun Hui Cho, the Virginia Tech shooter, James Holmes, Jared Loughner, Colin Ferguson, the Long Island shooter, all of these people passed background checks, even though they should have been prohibited. Now let me say this. I am glad that John acknowledged the federal firearms licensees at gun shows have to comply with a background check. Many people don't. So all we are talking about now when he's talking about universal background check systems are private sales. It is already a felony for somebody to engage in the business of selling firearms without having a license. ATF and other agencies can and do investigate that crime. It is already a felony for somebody to sell a gun to somebody whom they know or should know is a prohibited purchaser. That's already against the law. ATF can investigate that. It is already against the law for somebody to engage in a private gun sale when they know that gun is bound interstate. So that's another law that can be investigated. So all we are talking about here then are private intrastate sales and transfers that are not currently prohibited. So it is, one, a bit of a question whether for private interstate sales, Congress even has the authority to legislate in this area. But a more practical point is that the only way to enforce a universal background check system for private sales is if law enforcement authorities know what firearms are held by private citizens. And the only way they're going to know what firearms are held by private citizens is through a national firearms registry. Now, some people like the idea of a national firearms registry. John said, oh, and we should have no doubt that this is constitutional. I beg to differ. And one of the reasons for that was one of the animating features behind the Second Amendment, which is that if there is a national firearms registry and the government knows where your guns are, they can confiscate them whenever they want to. And there is a rich history, recent history, of dictators who have done that and non-dictators in this country who have done the same thing too. You want to have a voluntary background check system, that might work because for most law-abiding citizens don't want to place guns into the hands of bad guys. But a universal mandatory background check system, very problematic.
Jonathan Lowe, I do want to get to questions, but let me give you 60 seconds or so to respond.
Sure. I mean, first of all, I agree with John Malcolm that the records need to be put in the system to make background checks better. I agree completely. However, that is a separate problem. The reason we need universal background checks is because even people whose records, felony records, mental health records, or others are in the system can get guns from a quote-unquote private seller, no questions asked. I've yet to hear, I've been at the Brady Center for 16 years, I've yet to hear a reason why that makes sense. Also, the argument that you need total registration or any sort of registration in order to enforce universal background checks is completely incorrect. I mean, let me give you an example, and this is just one example, at a gun show. Today, since universal background checks are not required, if you are law enforcement, you see that there are some people with a table full of guns, or maybe just one or two guns, selling them without a background check. There is virtually nothing that law enforcement can do to stop that sale. While it's true that it's illegal to knowingly sell to a felon, how do you know? You can't know without a background check, and you have no obligation to even ask, which, of course, without a background check, you could get the answer from the felon, which is, no, I'm not a felon, and that would be good enough. Again, there's nothing that law enforcement can do, and while it's true that law enforcement can punish you for engaging in the business of selling guns without a license. The only way to enforce that is to literally follow people at gun shows or classified ads or whatever, from gun show to gun show, from sale to sale, and accumulate a sufficient body of evidence to show that they actually are engaged in the business. If you ask them at the gun show, why are they selling those guns, they'll say, my grandfather left me these guns, or my wife wants me to get them out of the house. That's a good enough reason. So, and this is a serious problem. And if you've met, as I have, parents and children and spouses who've lost loved ones, had them taken from them, from these background check, these gun sales without background checks, I think we all would not be so dismissive of them and to quibble with the numbers. So again, we do not need registration for this to work, and it's a separate problem from putting all of the records in the system.
Very good. Let's go to the audience. As I mentioned, we've got quite a few people on the line here. In a moment, you'll hear an announcement that the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting folks to join the queue, let me do a scheduling announcement about our Teleforum conference calls later this week. We've got a full schedule. Tomorrow, Maryland versus King, courthouse steps edition of Teleforum. Case is being argued tomorrow in the Supreme Court. It concerns DNA collection from a mere arrestee rather than someone who's convicted of a crime. That will be hosted tomorrow at 1 p.m. at this same number. On Wednesday, we'll have another Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum as two experts will attend oral arguments in the Shelby County case. That's the Section 5 Voting Rights Act case, and that will be Wednesday at 3 p.m. On Thursday, yet another Courthouse Steps edition looking at the case American Express versus Italian Colors Restaurant. That concerns arbitration agreements and class action litigation. That's going to be Thursday at 2 p.m. And then rounding out the week on Friday, we'll host a conference call at 1 p.m. Friday looking at an analysis of terrorist attacks in the United States and elsewhere. We've got quite a few callers now. It looks like seven callers with questions. So let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is David Applegate in Chicago, and I'd like to respond to some comments that Mr. Lowry made, specifically with respect to Chicago and his arguments why the horrendous murder rate here in this city do not show that prohibitions on guns don't work. He cites straw purchasers, supposedly in other places like Mississippi, and I'm not sure where else. But that does not explain where the places that these illegal guns come from don't have the high murder rate that Chicago does. Most of the murders using guns in Chicago are gang-related. Most of those gangs are protecting drug turf. And the reason that they engage in gangland-style shootings is the same reason that Al Capone and Bugs Moran engaged in gangland-style shootings in the 30s. It's because what they traffic in is illegal. In that case, intoxicating liquors, and today, drugs. So I think that when it comes to the Chicago issue, I respectfully submit that Mr. Lowry and others are completely off base. This is not a legality of weapons problem. It's really a legality of drugs problem, and it's trying to solve behavior that is already illegal, in part induced by making certain other conduct illegal, by making yet further conduct illegal. And respectfully, I'd like to submit that prohibition simply does not work. There are a lot of other good arguments for regulating gun sales, background checks, and the like, but this is not one of them.
Jonathan Lowy, you want to respond?
Sure. I mean, the issue is how do we make it harder for those gang members and other dangerous people to get guns? If we require background checks to all gun sales, it makes it harder. If we crack down on corrupt gun dealers, it makes it harder. If we prevent or prohibit bulk purchases of guns, something I didn't mention before. Right now, I have a case in which somebody bought 87 handguns in a single purchase, all in cash, from a licensed gun dealer, complied with all laws. Does that make sense? Does anyone here think that those guns were going to be used to protect that person's home? No, they were being trafficked. There are a lot of things we can do which can make it harder for guns to enter the criminal market. Will it turn gang members into angels? Will it eliminate all gun violence in Chicago or elsewhere? Of course not. It will make it harder. It will reduce gun violence. It will reduce access to guns by criminals.
John Malcolm, do you want to weigh in?
Yeah, you know, I, with all due respect to John, I appreciate the argument he's trying to make, but I think it's winking at reality. I mean, gangbangers and drug dealers are, for the most part, going to get their weapons on the black market, or they're going to steal them, or they're going to use straw purchasers. And by the way, it is already illegal to be a straw purchaser, and anybody who doesn't know that hasn't been paying attention to Operation, you know, Fast and Furious. Look, law enforcement has a tough task. They have a tough task in terms of going after gang members and drug dealers, and yeah, they probably have a tough task, you know, trying to identify bad sellers, whether they're at gun shows or over the internet or just across a neighbor fence. But, you know, that's why you have cooperating informants, and that's why you have undercover investigations, you know, and we should not be creating a monstrously expensive and burdensome system to trap the unwary. If you want to go after people who are in fact firearms dealers, but they're pretending not to be, investigate them. If you want to go after people who are making interstate sales, investigate them. If you want to go after people who are selling to prohibited purchasers, investigate them and do undercover investigations. All of those things are already against the law.
We've got six callers with questions. I'm going to ask our callers to be as concise as possible in framing their questions so we can get through as many of these as possible.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Let's examine a legal problem involved with treating persons as criminals because of some administrative determination that they are a dangerous person. If we grant the right to keep and bear arms, then the requirements for due process in the Fifth and 14th Amendments would seem to allow nothing less than a trial at which the petitioner seeks to disable the exercise of the right explicitly, and with the defendant having a right to a jury. If we allow some unknown administrator to determine that somebody is dangerous because they have had a history, quote unquote, of mental illness or drug abuse or alcohol abuse or domestic violence or whatever, without there ever having been a judicial determination that explicitly disabled the exercise of the right to keep and bear arms, as opposed to adjudicating some other question, then I think we seem to have a fundamental conflict between our due process protections and the aspirations of some to try to limit access to firearms.
Jonathan Lowey, you want to take a shot at that?
Well, I think that the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia's majority opinion in Heller, dispensed with a lot of those arguments, I believe. I mean, the court recognized that prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill and others remained constitutional. And the court, and this is Justice Scalia, made clear that Heller did not change that. I do understand you're making a due process argument, which is slightly different perhaps, but I don't think that I think your argument would have to be that Heller changed the law in some way regarding the rights, supposed rights of these dangerous people from having guns, and that was rejected.
Can I weigh in on that?
Go ahead, John Malcolm.
Yeah, I don't think that Heller dispensed with the issue, but I'm not sure, John, that I agree with the premise of your statement, which is that there are whole categories under 922G and 922N, which are the gun statutes, of people who are prohibited purchasers. And some of them are people who have been convicted of a felony, so then they would get the kind of due process rights that you've been talking about. But others are fugitives from justice, people who renounce their citizenship, drug, you know, people who are drug users, people who have been adjudicated mentally ill. And, you know, you are arguing for the most rigorous standard of due process before one can be deprived of the civil liberty. And I'm not saying that it's a normative matter that you are wrong, but, you know, there are all kinds of interests, including, by the way, liberty interests with respect to things like civil commitment, where you get judicial review, but you don't necessarily get an initial determination by a judge, in which you can lose that liberty interest, and the process that has been deemed due, at least for constitutional purposes, is something short of a trial or an adjudication by a judge. I'm not weighing in one way or the other, other than saying that the current state of the law at the federal level and certainly at the state level is that the process that is due is not always going to be a judicial determination following a trial and a conviction by a jury before you lose your Second Amendment right.
We have three callers with questions at this point. If you have a question for either of our experts, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, my name is Colonel Dennis Chapman, United States Army. I have served combat tours in two locations, Somalia and recently in Iraq, both instances as an infantry officer. So as you might imagine, I've been around assault rifles and machine guns off and on for a long time, the last 27 years. I'd like to address Mr. Lowery's comments. And I'm glad you made these comments because I've heard this a lot in the media and I've always waited for an opportunity to respond. You justify proposed bans on so-called assault weapons on the grounds that the features that make that define the weapon as an assault weapon are useful in combat and they're useful in crime. That seems to be based on a premise that the two situations require similar features in a weapon. And I'll say that is demonstrably false. In combat, as practiced by the United States Army, soldiers use their firearms as members of units engaged collectively in fire and maneuver against other collective groups of soldiers who are similarly armed. On the other hand, the mass shooting cases like Sandy Hook and Fort Hood, et cetera, you have a completely different situation. You have a situation where an assailant attacks, engaged in a surprise attack against an unarmed and unprepared group of civilians with no capacity to respond in like manner. Those are completely non-comparable situations, and the features that define a so-called assault weapon really are not particularly useful or do not enhance the lethality of the weapon in the mass shooting situation. For example, the bayonet lug. The United States Army has discontinued bayonet training. Bayonets are obsolete. Therefore, it's hard to see how that has any relevance at all. Pistol grips, again, they've already been addressed earlier. Collapsible stocks. Collapsible stocks are simply intended to allow you to adjust the rifle to your trigger reach, which is based upon how long your arm is. That's perfectly legitimate in sports settings as well as in combat. Some would say that that's about concealing the firearm. If concealability is what you're interested in, you would simply use a handgun. I can go on and on with these features. But let's look at the numbers. Rifles are used in about 3% of gun crimes, whereas the vast majority of instances of employment of a small arm in combat by regular soldiers are with rifles. Whereas the vast majority of crimes are committed with handguns, hard handguns are almost never used in combat by regular soldiers. the line of attack focusing on assault weapons is probably the single biggest reason why I, as a citizen of this country, would be unwilling to make any compromise whatsoever on gun issues, because the other side puts forth an argument that is demonstrably false. It's so false that it can only be mounted out of ignorance or bad faith. Thank you.
Jonathan Lowy or John Malcolm, do you want to respond?
Yeah, this is John Lowy. First of all, Colonel, thank you for your service. And I think, I mean, as far as the attributes of the assault weapon, I would focus on the pistol grips, which is that pistol grips enable a mass killer to spray fire. There was an old military usage of spray and pray, which is to, you're probably, more familiar with it than I am, but it enables you to spray an area indiscriminately, which is, again, very helpful if you're trying to mow down a lot of people, but not if you're facing an intruder in your home or if you're shooting a deer or engaged in other sport. High-capacity magazines as well. Having a 100-round drum that the Aurora shooter had, or the 30-round magazine that Loeffner had in Tucson, these are useful if you're trying to fire and gun down a lot of people without reloading. It would also have obvious usefulness in the military context. Not so for facing an intruder in the home. I know you can come up with a hypothetical scenario where a home invasion would require you'd be better off with a high-capacity magazine. I know you can come up with that. You can also come up with a scenario where a machine gun is necessary to defend your home. But that isn't the way we make policy in this country, and rightly so. And finally, I would hope, Colonel, and to all people listening, that there are places we can agree and places we can disagree, and that's just the way it works in politics. And you may have a disagreement, ultimately, about the assault weapon issue. We can respectfully disagree. But that shouldn't keep you from supporting universal background checks, for example. Because I would suggest if you don't support universal background checks, you are supporting the ability of felons and other dangerous people to buy guns, no questions asked. And I would hope you would disagree with that policy.
Can I weigh in on this? Yeah, first of all, Colonel, I also thank you for your service. I think John has it precisely wrong, which is a pistol grip does not allow you to spray a gun indiscriminately. In fact, a fully automatic weapon without a pistol grip is what would allow you to spray a gun indiscriminately. You still, with a semi-automatic weapon, one pull of the trigger per bullet. What the pistol grip does is allow you to stabilize the gun so that your second shot is likely not going to be indiscriminate, but is likely to stay focused on your target. And if you don't think that that is of use to somebody who is trying to defend themselves, who has been caught by surprise, who is not as experienced as the armed criminal that has broken into their home, it may be dark, they're nervous, the ability to stabilize a gun and fire a couple of times at the same target, that is incredibly useful to a law-abiding citizen who is trying to defend themselves, more useful to that law-abiding citizen than to the perpetrator of that crime. With respect to magazines, I don't have to, we haven't really talked about them, but there, again, the Supreme Court in the Heller decision said that what was constitutionally protected were things that are in common use. Well, the standard factory capacity magazine for many of the guns that are in common use for self-defense are 11 to 19 rounds, and for police it's up to 30 rounds. And if you think police are there to protect themselves and to protect us,
that's the purpose of self-defense. And I don't have to come up with a hypothetical example of where a high-capacity magazine might be useful. They used to have a state ban on high-capacity magazines in Arizona. Well, there's a lot of violence along the border between Arizona and Mexico, where ranchers frequently confront drug smugglers and human smugglers in that desert a lot of times when they're invading their home. And they found that in those situations, the person who's defending themselves would much rather have more ammunition than they need than discover that they didn't have enough they had enough to confront a perpetrator, and Arizona recognized that sufficiently that in 2012 they repealed that limit.
Well, gentlemen, we've got more questions than time, I'm afraid. Let's go to the next caller and ask everybody to be as brief as possible. We'll get through as many of these as possible in the next 5 minutes.
Mr. Lowry, this is Benny White in Tucson. I oppose the universal background checks, but I ask you. Where in the U.S. Constitution do you find authority for the Congress to regulate or otherwise control the sale or transfer of firearms between private individuals where there is no element of interstate commerce or crossing state lines?
Well, the Commerce Clause, and the fact is that firearms are – in addition to being made in interstate commerce, even without that, they are highly transportable and are transported across state lines. And that's why there have been some laws. There's one, I believe it was Montana, which attempted to exempt sort of homegrown Montana guns from federal firearms laws, saying if they were made in state and they were sold to be used in state, there was no interstate commerce involved or going to be involved. That was roundly rejected because of, among other reasons, the highly transportable and transported nature of firearms. I mean, to put simply, if you had that argument, you could have a state that could lower the bar and basically have no requirements whatsoever for people buying guns in their state. And, of course, there's nothing stopping those people from going to the next state. Dangerous people or with dangerous and unusual firearms and committing whatever havoc they could.
John Malcolm, do you agree on the Commerce Clause issue?
Well, it's difficult weighing in on the Commerce Clause after NFIB versus Avalius, and then you've got Raich on the other hand. I mean, the one thing I wanted to point out, though, is that the only thing that has not been regulated and that has been purely private sales intrastate. If you are concerned with anything else, whether it's at a gun show, through your neighborhood, classified ad, over the internet, ATF and other law enforcement agencies are perfectly free and do investigate those matters. And, you know, with respect to the rest, my argument is, how do you find out about such sales unless you have universal gun registration? And that is very problematic.
I mentioned before, I believe we have a hard stop on the hour, so we've got just 2 minutes left. Let's take what I think will be our final question.
Yes, this is Daniel Ogden in Carrollton, Texas. I'd like to ask Mr. Lowry if it was up to him whether he would vote to repeal the Second Amendment. And if your answer is no, I wonder why it would be no, because that would seem to really help to accomplish what you're trying. What is your objective?
The answer is no, and I think that we can have common sense gun laws that protect communities and keep guns, make it harder for keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people, make it harder for dangerous people and criminals to get guns while respecting the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding citizens. And I think that's an effective policy. And I also know that's where the American people are on this issue by vast majorities.
John Malcolm, you get the final word here.
I have nothing to add to that particular comment other than I suppose I'm pleased that John doesn't want to excise the Second Amendment from the Constitution without at least going through the proper amendment process.
Well, gentlemen, I think we've You've done a great job here today. I certainly want to thank both you, John Malcolm and Jonathan Lowy, for helping us with our call today. We might need to revisit this issue in the very near future, it sounds like, because I think our audience is left with a few questions. To our audience, thank you for joining us as well and for participating in the call today. I invite you to join our conference call tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number when we'll be discussing the oral argument in Maryland versus King, which will take place in the morning. Our call will be at 1 o'clock Eastern Time, but until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.